Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting the next interview in the continuing series with Dr. Maria Clavé, pioneering world-renowned computer scientist, president of HMC, board director Microsoft and Broadcom, speaker IFIP World CIO Forum, past dean of engineering, professor of computer science at Princeton University, former vice president and dean of science at UBC in Canada. Maria, you're an icon in so many domains where your innovations and accomplishments have laid foundations in science, education, leadership, innovation, and research. Now, this is the first in a series of interviews where we will explore your considerable history from your early years and into your professional life of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions in a number of fields, including societal causes. So thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, Stephen, it's always a great pleasure to talk with you. And it's been interesting preparing for this interview because, as you'll hear, I've had a somewhat turbulent life, and I just hope that others can learn from my many mistakes.
Well, Maria, in this next series of questions, then, we're going to take a chronological journey starting from the very beginning. And here's the first question. What are your earliest memories, and how do they correlate to where you are today?
So my first memory is my third birthday. I was given a swing set, and, I really felt that my birthday, at least for my birthday, I should be the most important person in the universe. And I had been wanting a swing for a very long time. And I was devastated when my parents insisted that I had to let my older sister try out the swing as well as my best friend. And, so my memory is I'm being sent to my bedroom, I'm looking out the window, and my best friend Dougie and my sister Anna are taking turns on my swing. So I think in terms of trying to correlate to where you are today, I think I've always had trouble. I'm better at it, I think, now than I was when I was turning three. But, learning that I really had to share things with other people, it took me a long time to get there.
Oh, I think one thing that's clear when I speak to your colleagues in that you're so curious and you have this questioning nature. So what triggered your questioning nature?
Well, it's interesting. I think my father was exactly that way. My daughter, Sasha, is that way. And I think all of us are interested in many, many things, but we also have this intense wish to change things for the better. And I think that when you're that way, no matter what you encounter, you're constantly trying to figure out how it works and if it could work better.
Currently you're the president of one of the finest undergraduate institutions in the world, Harvey Mudd. And yet, where did this all start? And I guess, what are some of your first early experiences, I should say, with regards to school? Like maybe your first good or bad experiences in school?
So I started out in school at George Watson's Ladies' College in Edinburgh, Scotland. My family moved there from Canada when I was four. And, my first good experience was in kindergarten. We had these rods called Cuisenaire rods, which, the ones were cubes, which were white, and, the tens were, of course, 10 units long, and they were golden. And I was making very complex geometric patterns with them. And I remember, being enormously pleased that my kindergarten teacher thought that this was really wonderful. And, having this very strong affirmation of, it was a combination of both math and art. And that was a wonderful experience. I think the bad experience for me was that I was extremely lonely at school until I was about eight, because my interests were so different from all the other students. I read incessantly, but what I wanted to read about was spy stories, adventure, science. I spent time doing things like drawing, tree climbing, building forts versus playing with dolls and dresses. And this was just a very lonely experience. And eventually, I became friends with another student, Janet Morton, who, like me, read all the time, and she was happy to join me in all kinds of adventurous activities that were usually reserved for boys. So, as you can hear from this, I was, from the youngest time I can remember, I really liked things that boys did and detested things that girls did, and this was just it was a strange experience. experience to be a person like that because it wasn't very common at that time.
I see. So I guess it made you quite unique in many ways. And, you know, you talk about your experiences or early experiences. I can see how that trended towards your, you know, fascination with mathematics and with and your art, which you continue to do in boardrooms, right?
So. Yes.
So now, if we talk about teachers, are there any particular teachers that inspired you, and how did they inspire you?
Well, so I think one teacher who stands out particularly for me was a music teacher whom I met first in eighth grade, and I had not played a musical instrument before then, but I wanted to learn to play the trumpet, and you'll hear the same over and over again, so girls didn't play the trumpet, so of course that was the instrument I had to learn. And, you know, she was enormously encouraging, and it turned out that she was a music teacher for my next 5 years because she also taught music at the high school that I ended up going to. And she was just inspirational about classical music, and I ended up learning to play probably about 5 different instruments during the time with her. And it was just, she took a real interest in me as a person, but she also, you know, made music become, you know, something that was accessible to me in a way that it hadn't been before.
So I'm curious then, how did she sort of display your sort of like a particular interest in you as a person? Like, what are some of these specific attributes that made her so outstanding?
Well, as I'll talk a little bit more later, one of the really hard things was that we moved back from Scotland to Edmonton when I was 12. And that was a very difficult transition for both me and my older sister, Anna, because I was 12, Anna was 15, and, it, you know, socially for me, just the change from being a private girls' school to a co-ed school was just enormously painful, and I had no friends and was, you know, just very, very isolated. And essentially, Mrs. Bryan, my music teacher, was the person who, you know, realized this was happening and actually asked a group of girls to adopt me at the end of, you know, at the beginning of ninth grade. And that was what, you know, really rescued me from an extraordinarily lonely time in my life. And so, you know, it was very clear that she took the time to get to know me as a person. She realized that I was going through a very difficult transition. And so it wasn't just that she taught me music. She actually found a way to help me, you know, bridge this transition between moving from Scotland to Canada.
Well, I guess a great lesson then is if you're in a community of some sort and you see some people being perhaps isolated, you know, reach out and try to mentor them or bring them into the group in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things I feel wonderful about MUD because, you know, MUD, I'd say, so MUD is full of people like me who have been very lonely. I mean, it's certainly not all the students, but in every year there's a certain number of students who have been very different from others around them and you know, have found it hard to build a community of people who they can talk with and feel like they belong. And, you know, one of the things I feel very good about MUD is that people, including me, but the faculty and the other students and staff, they make a huge effort to reach out to people like that and find ways for them to find a connection. And I think, you know, one of my huge attractions to being at MUD is knowing what was done for me when I was 12.
Well, that's really interesting, or the fact that you were able to get Bill Gates to come on to the campus and talk to students and to faculty. And, I mean, what an opportunity, right? So.
Yeah, just it's a wonderful thing.
Now, looking back, how would you describe yourself, your attitude, your approach to family, friends, activities, interests, hobbies, life in general, school, dreams of the future, your intended career?
So from my earliest days, my parents made it clear that they thought I was truly brilliant intellectually and also exceptionally talented as an artist. And my father was also enormously supportive of my interest in things that boys did. I was the second of 4 daughters, and he, you know, explicitly thought of me as his son, perhaps because my parents only intended to have 2 children, and so they had, you know, the first daughter, my sister Anna, and then they had me, and, you know, just, I was treated, I mean, my father really treated me like his son. He took me, and I did things with him all the time. My parents believed that I could accomplish anything that I chose to do. with the exception of sports. I was very clumsy and uncoordinated, so they thought of me as being athletically challenged. And I completely internalized this, and I was very surprised to discover much later, at the age of 37, that I actually had talent as a long-distance runner. Now, of course, you don't have to be coordinated to be a long-distance runner. You just have to be sort of determined. But it was interesting. My older sister, Anna, who I've mentioned, was 3 years older. She was a good daughter. And I was constantly in trouble with my parents because I argued about everything, especially with my father. And Anna, who's now one of my closest friends, absolutely hated me, despised me. In her eyes, I was unbearably arrogant, selfish, and troublesome. You know, go back to that three-year-old with the swing. And because I was troublesome, I got far more than my fair share of attention from my parents. I was very close friends with my next younger sister, Katrina, who's 4 years younger, and my youngest sister, who's 6 years younger, tended to partner with Anna. So we tended to sort of split up that Katrina and I would do things and Anna and Patricia would do things. As I mentioned, we moved from Edinburgh to Edmonton when I was 12. And I also mentioned it was very hard for both Anna and me. In Scotland, children were streamed into either focusing on languages or focusing on math science, and the streaming occurred after age 12. So Anna had chosen the language concentration, and so she had been, you know, spent 3 years without any math and science courses. And, you know, moving to Canada, everybody takes everything until they graduate from high school. And so she had to catch up on 3 years of math and science. And I have to say, I made, not deliberately, but I made, I think, things just that much more miserable for her because my dad would coach her. He'd usually be coaching her in the living room, and I would be in the family room and could hear what was going on. And I thought all the questions that they were going through were obvious, so I'd just call out the answer. And I had, you know, it didn't occur to me that this would be just that much more annoying to Anna, who was struggling with this material. I just, you know, thought it was fun to do. And yes, I was really obnoxious. For me, the devastation was social. I was, you know, very much an anomaly in my school in Scotland, in terms of, you know, it was a girls' school and most of the girls were fairly traditional. But I think Britain has much more tolerance for eccentricity. And so I was just an eccentric student and, you know, that was fine. In Edmonton, I started in grade 8. The students were a year older. And as I mentioned, it was my first experience in a co-ed school, and I immediately was the teasing target for many of the boys in my class. I had a funny accent. I was used to wearing the same clothes every day. I mean, in Scotland, you wore the uniform, the school uniform, and you had, you know, basically a couple of blouses and one tunic, and that's what you wore. And so I just translated this. And, you know, this is at the time where if you wore the same skirt 2 days in a row, people would make fun of you. Well, I just wore the same skirt every day. And then the other thing was in Scotland, this is sort of embarrassing, but, you know, the expectation was that you took a bath once a week. And in North America, you take a bath every day or take a shower every day. So the boys made fun of all of this. And I just had never been in a situation like that. I had really didn't know what to do with it. The girls were much nicer to me, but I had absolutely nothing in common with them. I was still into building tree forts. They were into romance, makeup, music, shopping, etc. And for more than a year, I was friendless and you know, really very seriously contemplating suicide, which was when my music teacher, Mrs. Bryan, stepped in. It was an amazing transition. She asked this group of girls to adopt me, and it made a huge difference. Even though I was still very geeky and different from these girls, I was no longer nearly as lonely. They just, you know, invited me to things, and I went with them, and they were just nice. In grade 10, I decided it was time to figure out how to fit into the high school culture. And I asked a very popular girl in the next grade up, Wendy Cook, for her advice. She told me that I needed to get a professional haircut, shower every day, and get some reasonable clothes. And, you know, the amazing thing, and she did it really nicely. I took her advice, and it worked like a charm. All of a sudden, I was no longer seen as a social outcast. I was just one of a great group of students who were the academic achievers and musicians in the school. I was part of several clubs, orchestra, band, science, art, theater. I loved every subject except for phys ed, so my clumsiness and lack of coordination made me feel pretty awful, and social studies, which I thought was stupid. And I dreamed of being an astronaut, artist, poet, scientist, architect, or engineer. and life was great. So, you know, it went from being an intensely lonely time to my figuring out what it took to sort of act a bit more like the other people and then being accepted.
Are you still in touch with some of these people from that time?
I am. I just came back from, one of my friends from that time, Lisa Hyam, who's a professor at the University of Calgary in computer science. We go hiking every year in the Canadian Rockies. And so we were in high school together, and then we were in university together. So, and we had our 40th high school reunion 3 years ago, I think, and which was pretty wonderful. We had maybe 130 people out of our graduating class, so about 500 there. So, yeah, Lisa's the person I'm closest to, but I still know a few of the people from then.
Now, who were your first mentors? And I think you've described at least one. And how did they influence you?
Well, you know, obviously my parents had a huge influence on me because they really believed that I could do things. And, you know, my music teacher as well. I should also mention my math teachers. I had some very good math teachers in high school. And math was always something that, you know, until many years later, I didn't really feel like there was anything to learn. It just seemed so natural. And they would let me, I would sit in classes and I would generally do my homework for other subjects. And they would explicitly acknowledge that that was a perfectly reasonable thing for me to do, so long as I could always answer any question instantly. And so, you know, once an hour or so, the math teacher would ask me a question and I would answer it. And it's hard to explain because it sounds sort of ridiculous, but they really made me feel like mathematics was something that belong to me or that I belong to or something like that. So there was somehow a great deal of affection and support for my being interested in mathematics and good at mathematics.
So now, can you describe further your early years and five pivotal events that shaped you before you entered university?
So, I mean, as I mentioned, my father always supported my belief that I was essentially a boy. And, you know, I spent my spare time with him gardening, doing woodwork, doing puzzles, reading books, while my aunt, sister Anna spent her time helping my mother with cooking, caring for younger sisters, etc. And I think it was very important because I ended up choosing many things that were non-traditional for girls and eventually for women in my life. And I think that if my father had not been so supportive, it would have been much harder to do that. I think that another thing that was really pivotal was establishing friends. You know, my first friend, Janet Morton, taught me that even though I seemed to be so different from most of the people around me, it was possible to find somebody with similar interests and abilities. And, you know, I think until I met her, I felt very isolated and disconnected. And just having one friend made a huge difference. Another thing that was really pivotal in my development was that soon after we moved to Canada, I discovered that I was an atheist. We had attended an Anglican church in Edinburgh that had an extraordinary choir, and I loved going to church because I just loved the music. And when we moved to Edmonton, the church choir was not one that I felt interested in listening to. And because I didn't want to go to church, I started thinking about whether I actually believed anything involved in the religion and realized that I didn't believe any of this, and told my parents that I would no longer attend church. Now, you know, my parents, when I was baptized, they made a promise to raise me within the faith, and they were absolutely horrified. And we had, this argument went on literally for 6 months. And eventually my parents agreed that they couldn't force me to believe something that I didn't believe, and that if I didn't believe, it made no sense for me to attend church. And this was my first major intellectual battle with my parents that I actually won. And, you know, I think it, for me, established that I could make my own choices. Then I'd say the next thing that I learned, and it's, again, a recurring theme, was when I made this transition to really try to learn how to function within this culture in Canada, or I mean, I'd say it was probably similar to the U.S. culture as well, in grades 9 and 10, I was very lucky to have some people, particularly a group of girls, my music teacher, who helped me make the transition. Making that transition helped me learn that I could change superficial things about myself without compromising what I thought of as the real me. And I've had to adjust many times, and I have to say always with difficulty, to new cultures in my career. But learning that it was possible and being willing to try to do it has, you know, from that time has become an important skill. And then the final thing that came out of that period is that in my last year of high school, with urging a group of close friends who wanted to co-write the valedictorian's address, I decided to be the top student in my class and hence valedictorian. And I had never studied for exams before. I just went and wrote them, and I did reasonably well. But for the first time, I actually studied, and I became the top student. And I learned two things out of that. One was that I actually could work when I decided that I wanted to achieve something. But the second one was what happened when we wrote the valedictorian's address. This was 1968 when I was about to graduate, and student protest was just starting in both the United States and Canada at that time. And we wrote, and I delivered, a speech that criticized our school for spoon-feeding us. Now, I went to Strathcona High School. The teachers were great, and I received a really good education. And I had always been a very well-behaved and respectful student. And so the fact that I gave this address that basically, you know, told students that they were going to have to learn for themselves and, you know, become much more independent in their thought and all of these kinds of things was just horrified the principal and the teachers. And it was also my introduction to the student protest movement that became a very big part of my life in the next few years. So it was somehow that was the time of transition from being the student that was really trying to a large extent meet everyone's expectations to being someone who wanted to branch out and really start making decisions and having ideas for myself. And, you know, it's interesting. I'd obviously done that clearly with my family long before. I had challenged everything and was always in trouble for that. But I'd never really done it in the school context. And so that was a very big transition.
I see. So that continues to this day in all aspects of your work, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just reminded of when Steve Ballmer visited your office, and there's this sort of exchange, but you were accustomed to that. I mean, it wasn't strange to you.
No. I mean, it's a very good thing. Microsoft has a culture where people challenge each other and disagree and so on and so forth, and it's one I'm very familiar with.
But sometimes people will find that hard or difficult. How do you deal with that?
I really have tried hard. One of the things I've realized is that as I get older, and also am in a position of, you know, a responsible influence, you know, for instance, being president of a college, I work really hard to try and not be as challenging in the way I interact with people, and, you know, just because it's too threatening. I won't say I'm always successful, but I do work on it.
Or I guess the other thing is when you exchange with faculty as well, right? I mean, you are the president and...
Exactly, and I have to be, I mean, I work really hard with faculty to be, not to express opinions strongly and not to challenge their opinions because it's just, it can come across as really threatening. And I don't mean it that way, but it's just not the right way. I mean, I need them to feel comfortable expressing themselves and not feel that the president is, you know, going to argue with them because it feels very uncomfortable to them. So, yeah, but it's certainly my natural nature is just to get into an argument about something because it's the way I learn. And sometimes it's definitely not the right thing to do.
Or Derek says, you never lose an argument.
I lose lots of arguments. Especially with my kids and Nick, you know. I mean, it's. I think one of the things that happens when you get older is winning is less important.
Now, what was remarkable about your time as an undergraduate?
So the first thing is I decided that I would go to the University of Alberta, where both my parents taught. And I had applied to Queen's and UBC as well, but, you know, the One of the things about the way scholarships work in Canada is the largest scholarships, at least at the time when I was going to college, were if you stayed in your own province. And it was clear that it would have been much more affordable for my parents if I went to the University of Alberta, partly because I'd be living at home and partly because I had the INCO scholarship. Probably the first really important thing that happened was 3 days before I started classes, I switched from majoring in engineering to majoring in honors mathematics. And this was because I learned that engineering students were not allowed to take the honors math classes, and you know, there's just no way I wasn't going to take those classes. This meant that I gave up a $500 scholarship, which doesn't sound like much money now, but it was a lot of money in 1968 from the Alberta Professional Engineering Association, but it was worth it. When I started my first honors math class, it was a calculus class taught by Jack Mackey. And it was just the most wonderful class I've ever had in my life. He started, it was a year-long class, but he spent the first 2 weeks giving an overview of the entire curriculum for the year. And I just remember sitting there and not wanting to blink because I might miss something. And it was really, I think, something that cemented my love for mathematics. And I've taught calculus a number of times since then. It's probably my favorite class to teach, and it's really because he was just so inspirational. It was just so beautiful. And during my first year, I got heavily involved with the student protest movement at the university. And, you know, there was a sit-in in the president's office and so on. And I visited UC Berkeley the following summer, was arrested in demonstrations against the shooting of James Rector. The Alameda County Sheriff phoned my parents because at this point I was still under 18. And you can imagine their reaction. They had thought I was visiting a friend in Montreal. So they get this phone call at midnight from the Alameda County Sheriff saying their daughter has been arrested for failure to disperse in the state of emergency. So when I returned home, my parents issued an ultimatum. Either I gave up politics, sex, and drugs, or I'd have to move out and stay away from the family when I turned 18 because they were afraid I was going to destroy my two younger sisters' lives by getting them involved with politics, drugs, and sex. So, you know, at that point, they essentially felt that, especially my father, but I'd say both of my parents felt that I was lost, that, you know, I had been lost to this terrible world of sort of hippies and student protest and so on. And, of course, when they gave me this ultimatum, I was 2 weeks away from my 18th birthday, but I left that day. And my parents, you know, discussed how much support I would need to live on my own and with my sister Anna, and came up with a figure of $125 per month. I accepted the support for the first 2 months, but then after that, I never accepted financial aid from my parents or financial support, and put myself, you know, was financially independent from then. And so, you know, what I essentially did was I did a lot of grading math courses, teaching art, doing art. I was actually the art consultant for a small, on retainer for a small film company for a couple of years in Edmonton, and, you know, doing just various drawings and things for them, for the company. So that was, you know, a huge change at the end of my first year of university.
Sounds almost entrepreneurial.
It's really painful, I gotta say. Basically my parents, you know, my father disowned me. Now, of course, they didn't really disown me because every once in a while they would, you know, try and reestablish relationships, and they'd invite me home for dinner, and I'd be in the house for anything from 3 minutes to 2 hours before my father blew up at me and kicked me out again. So, you know, just hard. On the academic side, I was finding my university courses extremely easy, so my second year I decided to save time and I stopped going to lectures and just did the homework assignments. And I continued to do well academically and was encouraged to enroll in some graduate classes in my third year. I was also in my third year elected student government as part of the student protest slate. But during that fall of my third year, I decided that I was going to drop out of university at Christmas. And I think the biggest thing was I really wanted to feel that I could contribute something useful to the world, and I really liked pure mathematics, but I couldn't see how that would allow me to contribute anything. And on top of that, I'd been in touch with somebody, whom I'll call PH, that I'd met two summers before while briefly visiting Yale University. PH had dropped out and was living in Vermont making candles. He invited me to visit, and at Christmas, I went. We decided to spend the next year or so traveling to India, and completely independently, my parents decided to spend a year in India while my father did a project with the UNDP in Hyderabad. And despite my separation from my parents over the preceding 2 years, they asked that PH and I visit them when we arrived in India. Now, it just happened that the war between India and Pakistan broke out 3 days after we entered India, and just as we arrived at my parents' house. And because the United States was supporting Pakistan, there was intense anti-United States sentiment in India, and the United Nations was expecting to have to evacuate all North Americans, since Indians couldn't tell Canadians from Americans, any day. And my parents were totally horrified by the thought of their being evacuated while we remained in India, and begged us to stay with them until the situation became clearer. Because I desperately wanted to rebuild my relationship with my parents, we agreed. And as the war continued over the 3 months, things grew even tenser between my father and me. He found it incredibly embarrassing for his unmarried daughter to be traveling with, in his words, a hippie dropout. And eventually, PH and I decided the best solution was to get married, since that would please my parents. We were married on New Year's Eve, and the war ended a week later. You know, I really thought for a long time we should have gotten married several months before. Even better, my father decided he now liked PH and regularly commented on how much cleaner and more intelligent we were than the other hippies he saw in India. And a few days later, we left to explore India on good terms with my parents. During the next 3 months we spent in India, I realized I was missing mathematics intensely. So I realized this because I was playing chess, which I don't like. And I was reading recreational mathematics books, and I was just hopelessly missing mathematics. So I wrote to the math department at the University of Alberta to let me return as a PhD student. So, you know, just to recall, I had dropped out in the middle of my third year, and because the courses were full-year courses, I basically had credit for 2 undergraduate years. But I still thought that I should come back as a PhD student. So they were extremely gracious in their response. They said they'd be happy to have me back, but I couldn't start my PhD without completing my honors Bachelor of Science degree in mathematics. But as a compromise, they suggested that instead of taking the remainder of my undergraduate math classes, I could replace them by the corresponding graduate courses. And they said that if I did sufficiently well, they would give me my honors degree, despite the fact that I'd only have about 3 years worth of courses. So I accepted this offer, and so the next September, I had been gone for 20 months, and I was taking a slate of graduate classes. Now, one of the things I really hadn't accounted for was not only was I missing the undergraduate prerequisites for these graduate classes, but I had forgotten virtually everything I had learned in mathematics before because I had been away for almost 2 years. So I was in these courses, and for the first time, this is the first time in my life that mathematics wasn't just obvious. I mean, just before, it was just something you did. You barely had to think about it. It was just like you lived it, you breathed it, and it was just there. And now all of a sudden, I was faced with trying to learn stuff where I was having enormous difficulty learning it. And so for the first time in my life, I had to work really, really hard. And I did work really hard. And what I suddenly discovered was I totally loved it. And I ended up doing fine, but it changed me from someone who, had basically just sort of coasted through everything to someone who loved working really, really hard. And that was just a phenomenal change.
Well, that's quite a remarkable departure, right, from, as you indicated, just sort of doing it, but now putting all the work behind it, almost like Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours.
Yeah, I mean, it just, I became a just fundamentally different person.
So what 5 forces then shaped you at that time?
Well, the first one I would say is the student protest movement. I mean, I think, and that is something that I think has really changed, has really formed how I think about students. Before the student protest movement, students didn't serve on really any committees at universities. They were really just not engaged. They were thought of as people who showed up in the classes. And after the student protest movement, you started having student representatives on just about everything. And one of the things I feel extremely strongly is that students have enormously valuable input to the functioning of a university or college. And so being part of that movement, I think, has made me someone who absolutely any decision I would want to have, I want to hear from students. And, you know, so for example, when we did our strategic planning at both Princeton and at Harvey Mudd College, we had students involved at every stage, and, you know, undergraduate students and graduate students. And it was, I think, the first time at both places that students had really been consulted in that way and engaged in thinking about the future of the institution. So that was clearly, you know, something that really has formed my view of being an educator, is just the importance of listening to students and understanding from their experiences and their insights. The second really big thing was, of course, the pain of separation from my family, particularly, you know, this feeling that I had lost my father's belief in me. And because it's, you know, it's very clear to me as my life has gone on, the fact that my father believed I could do anything was just an incredible source of support at times when I took on challenging initiatives. And that period of, it's really only about 2 years, you know, maybe 3 years, where that was absent was, I just can't begin to describe how painful it was. And yet, I think it was really necessary because at some point I had to take responsibility for what I wanted to do, not just be the person who was both trying to fulfill my father's dreams, but also fighting like crazy against my father because I didn't want to be fulfilling his dreams. I wanted my own dreams. Taking full financial responsibility for myself was really important. And it's something, you know, my father for many years afterwards said that one thing he always respected was that I wouldn't accept financial support from them. That he said that if I was going to follow my own ideas and live my life in ways that were totally different from what he would choose for me, the fact that I didn't ask him to support me in that was something that he really respected. The traveling around the world with PH and, you know, I mean, just, that was an amazing experience. I mean, we spent time, we hitchhiked from, Scotland to Venice. We took trains and buses from there to India. We spent time in Afghanistan and Turkey, in Iran, and 6 months total in India. I mean, it just was an amazing experience and, you know, taught me a lot about just, I mean, we were living on, you know, about 25 cents a day most days. And so we were not eating a lot and we certainly were not staying in hotels. And it was a very good way to see the world. And I think you have to be young to actually be able to do that. I mean, I don't think I could do it today, but it was good. And then, of course, probably the most important part was finding out how important mathematics was for me and how to work hard and really the importance of working hard and what it meant.
Now, earlier you talked about Anna and you know, and your sort of relationship. So where was that? How was that relationship at this moment in your
life? At this moment, I was still the troublemaker, the person she didn't want to have anything to do with. I will get to how that changed.
Okay.
I was still, you know, despite the fact that I was forbidden from seeing, you know, my younger sisters, I, of course, saw Katrina quite a lot. I didn't see much of Patricia, but, you know, I mean, it was, you know, I think for Anna at that point, I had just, you know, proved that I was the horrible, rotten person she'd always thought I was.
And something else that you talked about is, you know, this idea of student representation, and that's even reflected in your current work where you're president and you have students involved. Now, in that student representation, do you seek only the top students? Do you try to get a lot of diversity in that input?
At Mudd, every student is a top student, right? I mean, there is no such thing as an unexceptional student at Mudd. I mean, they're all amazing. But, you know, I would say, at UBC, there's a much greater range. And one of the things I did while I was Dean of Science at UBC was start the Science Ambassadors Program. And one of the things I've been trying very hard, both as Vice President and then as Dean of Science, was how to get the students at UBC to really feel engaged. And, you know, I tried lots of different things, forums, various kinds of events and so on. And I finally discovered that the way to get them engaged was to ask them to volunteer, that was what really worked. And so we had the Science Ambassadors Program was a program where we had roughly about 200 undergraduate volunteers who would, you know, do everything from being judges at science fairs and taking, you know, visiting government ministers on tours and, you know, so on and so forth. And but one of the components was, you know, so developing leadership development, public speaking, things like that. And it was a great program because, you know, virtually anyone could do it. It wasn't aimed at the honor students. It wasn't aimed at people who were necessarily, you know, in student government. It was something that was for all students. And, you know, I think if you're trying to have an educational institution that works for the students that are there, you need to listen to a broad range of the students. I mean, only listening to the best students gets you a very biased understanding of what their experience is.
Well, that's, you know, very interesting. So now going back to your undergraduate days, then what were some of the good and bad experiences from that time?
Well, you know, obviously the good experiences, I had many good experiences as an undergraduate student. I mean, I have to say the math professors at the University of Alberta were very good to the honors math students. I mean, they invited us to their homes. They cared about us as individuals. They, you know, they really believed in us. And I also had some very good friends from that time. Lisa, who I mentioned, we were both math majors together and, you know, honors math majors, but others as well. And I enjoyed being part of student government. I mean, it was very bizarre. There were 25 people on student council, and 13 of the 25 were part of the student protest slate, including the person who was president of student government. But that meant that there were 12 people who were not. And so we were absolutely stalemated. It was sort of like what's going on in the federal government in the U.S. right now. We couldn't pass anything because the chair couldn't vote. So it was just, it was very interesting. I mean, it gave me, I think one of the things is when you participate in student government, you get to see a different side of how universities run. And I think it was a good experience. Obviously, traveling was a great experience. That was totally wonderful. And, you know, the bad experiences were, you know, the separation from my family. I mean, that was awful. Just truly, truly awful.
You know, throughout this discussion, I can see a lot of decision points. So how did you make your choices and why?
So, I was thinking about that, and I feel that during that period, it's roughly a five-year period, since I was out of school for 2 years and in school for roughly 3 years, it felt like I was really searching to find out who I was. And in dropping out of university, I was rejecting the role I'd been cast in. You know, I mean, throughout my time in high school, I was sort of an academic superstar, and I was going to do these great things, and I was going to get a PhD, and I was going to And it felt like when I chose to drop out of university, I was, for the first time, sort of saying, okay, I'm going to decide what I'm going to do, and I'm going to find out what's important for me. And that was a very terrifying and liberating choice at the same time. But, of course, what was so wonderful was that when I found out I really needed to do mathematics, I did, you know, I could come back, and then I could really be a student and embrace it for, you know, for what it really was. And, you know, I was there because now I was going to learn mathematics. I was going to do mathematics. I was going to be a mathematician. And that was such a different way to see it from when I'd been there before, when I was doing extremely well academically, but I was not in any sense really invested in it.
You're taking these graduate courses really during your undergraduate years. So how can you I don't know how to phrase this, but then you become a graduate student in a sense, right? Because then you get your PhD and beyond. So describe that time as a graduate student. Is there a time as a graduate student and beyond, and five inflection points?
There's definitely a time as a graduate student. So, you know, I mean, I took these graduate courses and in my final year as an undergraduate. So that meant I was ready to, you know, take my comprehensive exams during the fall of my first year, right at the beginning of my first year as a graduate student. So, you know, I was maybe a year ahead in terms of timing entering graduate school. I went to the U of A, and, you know, I went to the U of A because it wasn't clear I was going to get, I mean, those days in Canada, you couldn't really go into a PhD program without having an honors bachelor's degree. And there was this deal that, you know, that the university had said, if you get, you know, a certain average on, you know, in your courses, we'll give you an honors degree. But that wasn't going to be clear until the end of that year, and so I didn't apply anyplace else. And I also got an NSERC, scholarship for graduate school. But again, it was really sort of predicated on my going to the University of Alberta because of the questions about whether I'd have this honors degree or not. So anyway, I started at the University of Alberta, and I still had, even though I'd taken a bunch of graduate courses, there were still lots of graduate courses that I wanted to and needed to take. And fairly on, I started working with a research advisor. Now, you'll recall that I had gotten married in India, and so, PH was also in Edmonton and wanted to study zoology, eventually study genetics. I started working with this research advisor, and within, a few months, we had fallen head over heels in love, and, within the next year or so, that ended both of our marriages, so it took a while to actually officially happen. I switched to a different research advisor, Tony Lau, who, was my research advisor for my thesis at the end of my second year, and Tony was just an amazing mentor. He introduced me to the field of left amenable semigroups, and I ended up solving three long-standing problems in the field during my third year as a graduate student. But at the same time, my relationship with my initial advisor had become extremely destructive. And I ended it at the end of my third year as a graduate student and spent the fourth and last year of my PhD at the University of British Columbia writing up my results and applying for every academic job for pure mathematicians in both Canada and the United States, which was 83 applications in total. And it was not a good time to be applying for math positions in academia. There were only two tenure track openings in all of Canada. I didn't get either of them. I did get one tenure track offer from Oakland University, which is a medium-sized university in Michigan, about 25 miles of Detroit, and I accepted that job offer and started my career as an assistant math professor there. I hated it, not so much because of Oakland University, but because of the lack of all the things I treasured from Vancouver and Edmonton, like ethnic restaurants, live music, foreign movies, bookstores, Canadians. Oakland was in the middle of nowhere. I mean, literally in the middle of fields. It's not today. There's actually all of these things that are available around Oakland University. But at that point, it was in the middle of fields, and there were just none of the things you would expect around a university. And so I was just, really miserable and lonely. But during that year, I discovered that there were well-known mathematicians who worked in computer science departments, and that there were tons of job openings, academic jobs for computer scientists. The only issue was I knew nothing about computer science. So I decided that I would do a second PhD in computer science, and I talked to faculty members at MIT, Stanford, and University of Toronto, which at the time were the top three departments for theoretical computer science. MIT said that they'd be happy to have me, but they couldn't promise funding. Stanford said I had missed the application deadline by 2 months. And Toronto said, this is Derek Corneal, who I was talking to at Toronto, is, you're Canadian. We'd love to have you because we have some funding that is reserved for Canadian graduate students. And at that point, most of their graduate students were coming from the U.S. So the following September, so this is now 1978, I started Toronto taking five graduate computer science courses in the first semester. Of course, I didn't have any of the prerequisites. But, of course, I'd been through this before in mathematics when I came back from India. So just like before, I worked like crazy and I did fine. And by January, I was being asked to apply to computer science tenure track jobs in Canada. And when I came back from an interview at the University of Calgary in January, I found a message that I should phone the chair of the computer science department at the University of Toronto immediately. When I did so, this is Pat Hume, he asked why I hadn't applied for the job opening at the University of Toronto. And I mumbled something about Toronto was a great department and I hadn't finished my PhD yet. And he said I'd better have an application on his desk by 9 a.m. on Monday morning. So I did apply to Toronto, and he hired me as an assistant professor starting the following July, so July 1979. So, my life goes from I finished my PhD in mathematics in 1977, I take a job at Oakland University for 1 year. I mean, I took a leave to go back to Toronto. I go to Toronto, and now I have a job at the University of Toronto. So that fall, I was, in addition to teaching a compiler course, and I knew nothing about compilers, and an introductory computer science course, which, of course, was okay, I was asked to run the computer systems seminar. And the second speaker was a young star in theoretical computer science from IBM Research in Yorktown Heights called Nick Pippinger. Now, it just happened that the morning I met Nick, I had sworn off men for all time. I had just broken up with a Hungarian mathematician. And in addition, Nick was completely different from anyone I'd ever dated. Superficially, we could not have been more different. I loved to travel. He hated it. I loved outdoor activities. He didn't. I loved to spend time with friends. He was the shyest person I'd ever met. But we found we could talk up forever about everything, math, science, music, art, values. 10 days later, after many hours of horrendously expensive long-distance phone calls, this is when it cost like $100 to spend an hour on the phone between Toronto and New York, Nick returned to visit for a weekend. Nick was 32, I was 28, and when we talked about what we each wanted and someone to marry, there was a lot of agreement. We were engaged 4 weeks later and married 8 months after that. Toronto had been trying to recruit Nick for years, so they were delighted to offer him a full professorship. MIT math department tried to recruit both of us too, but in the end, we decided to move to a new theoretical computer science group with IBM Research in San Jose, and we started there in July 1980. Now, there were a number of reasons why we made this choice. Because of Nick's shyness, I knew being married and having children would be a very big transition for him without the added stress of having to teach classes. And for me, it was an opportunity to focus on research for a few years and to establish myself, my career as a theoretical computer scientist.
Well, that's a fascinating story, and I know Derek shared some of those same kind of stories from his perspective. So.
Yeah. Well, he probably also told you that, well, I'll talk about this a little bit. I found the transition to the culture in computer science fairly hard. And so there was a while when I had a sign on my office door that said, all computer scientists are idiots.
Derek was also sharing, provided feedback to Kelly on one of his books, right? So.
Yeah.
I think it was a data structures book.
It was a data structures book, absolutely. Yeah. So.
Do you want to share any of that, or?
No.
Okay.
I found the style of writing. What's the right word? Computer science is. I found it very sloppy compared to mathematics. And now, after you make the transition, you can understand. There are actual benefits as well as disadvantages to the way that computer science does things. But it's. You know, it's probably easier to read something in computer science and get the general idea much easier than in mathematics. But on the other hand, there's much less accuracy in the definitions and also I think, theoretical computer science has changed a lot in the last, 30 years, 35 years, in that it is much more mathematically precise than it was in the early days. But yeah, I was very outspoken in my criticisms.
So are you saying that computer science at that time was a little bit fuzzy while mathematics was very precise?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really true. If someone presented an idea and the basic idea was right, even though the details were wrong, they would be comfortable with that. It's like fixing up those details, Now, of course, sometimes the details couldn't be fixed, but, there was sort of that attitude. Whereas in math, there was a lot more attention to getting the definitions and the proofs actually correct and being able, taking responsibility that you really needed to do that. So, yeah.
Now, who were your mentors at that time and how did they influence you?
So, obviously my advisor, Tony Lau, was an incredible mentor. And, I often say that, he just really taught me about how to be a good academic citizen, how to be a good researcher, about taste, about ethics, about responsibility. And, it's very interesting if you look at what his students have done. I think he's had 17 PhD students at this point. I'm number two. Number one is Keith Taylor. Keith ended up being was Dean of Science at Halifax. Brian Forrest, who I forget what number Brian is, was chair of the pure math department at Waterloo. I mean, there's just something about Tony's students have played a lot of leadership roles in the mathematics community in Canada. And he just, it's hard for me. He's only six years older than I am. And, of course, he seemed like he was a dozen years older than me at the time, at least. But he just is an extraordinary person. He was also, you know, very supportive about my decision to move to theoretical computer science, even though, you know, at the time, most of the people in the math department at the University of Alberta just thought it was a tragedy. I mean, they thought it was just the most ridiculous thing I could think about doing, because they didn't see computer science as being an interesting field, and, you know, I was a good mathematician, and I shouldn't be leaving mathematics. But Tony was, you know, one of the few people who just said, if you want to do that, I'm completely supportive. And then, again, when we decided to go to IBM Research, again, that was a very unusual thing to do at the time. And he was just supportive. Other people who were, you know, supportive of my move to learn computer science, Vlasic Fadl, who at that time was a professor of computer science and operations research at Stanford, was really the first person who told me that there were mathematicians. I mean, I knew his name as a mathematician, and, you know, finding out that he was in the computer science department was amazing. Ron Graham and Alan Hoffman, two very well-known mathematicians, were also very supportive. And, of course, Derek Corneille was the person who admitted me to the PhD program at Toronto, and he was incredibly supportive. So Derek and I had met first during that final year of my PhD when I was at the University of British Columbia, and I sat in on a course that he was teaching. He was on sabbatical. And so it wasn't completely that I just, this person he'd never met before called up. And so, you know, he'd been impressed with some of the things I had done and sitting in his course. He helped me start my research in theoretical computer science by inviting me to be part of collaborations with David Kirkpatrick and Andrei Proskurovsky. And then, of course, you know, once I met Nick, Nick became my central mentor and best friend and has remained so for the rest of my life. You know, I would say Tony and Derek, in many ways, sort of formed. It's hard to figure out how to say this exactly, but they were both. You know, my life was not so stable at the time, and I'll talk a little bit about this in a while. But I had, in ending this very destructive relationship with my initial advisor at the University of Alberta, I was emotionally not in good shape. And they were both people who, I would use the phrase the salt of the earth to describe them. Enormously good human beings, wise, caring, in, you know, married to somebody they truly loved. And to me, they were sort of like this, you could look at them and you could sort of believe that it was possible for people to actually be happy and, you know, have a good life and all those kinds of things. And I sort of, for quite a long time, they were sort of my examples. And then, you know, when I met David Kirkpatrick, he was another one. Okay, there are people who have found a partner that they can make their life with, who can reach out and help other people and so on. So they were very important to me.
So when are the last times that you've talked to Tony or Derek?
Well, Tony I talked to a couple of months ago. I see Tony pretty much most times that I'm back in Edmonton. And Tony turned 65 last year, and so there was a conference in his honor, and I was the dinner speaker at the banquet the first night. So Tony, I talk to pretty often. Derek, I haven't seen for quite a while. I think the last time we talked was, just before or just after Ken Savchuk's death. But I sort of feel like I could see Derek any time, and no time would have passed.
Well, you were missed at Kelly Gottlieb's celebration 90th, right?
So. I did. That would have been a great opportunity, but there was just no way I could be there.
Now, what five lessons did you learn from this period or at this time?
Yeah, so, you know, one of them was, you know, I think before I had this relationship with my initial advisor, I really believed that love and determination and hard work and whatever could conquer anything. And it just wasn't true. And so, you know, one of the things up until then, I'd never really given up on anything that I really wanted. And it was the first time where I just had to say, no matter how much I want this to work, it's not going to work, and I have to walk away from it. And so I just learned that sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes you actually have to give up. Then the second thing was, you know, after that ended, I was just devastated, and for really quite a long time afterwards. But the first thing I did after leaving this person was to go spend 2 weeks with my older sister, Anna. Now, this was the first time we actually ever talked to each other, and it was the most extraordinary thing. She was married and living in Winnipeg, and her husband, who was doing a postdoc in chemistry at the University of Winnipeg, University of Manitoba, she would go leave in the morning, leaving us sitting talking to each other at the breakfast table, and he would come back at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd still be in the same spot, still talking. And because it was as though we were rediscovering, I mean, since we had literally never had a conversation, and we were talking about our lives and how we perceived our parents and the family and all these different things that happened in our lives. And I was 22, and no, I was 25, and she was 28. And it was just the most extraordinary experience, and we've been very close friends ever since. And from Anna's perspective, it was the first time I ever needed her, and I really did need her. And, you know, the thing I think I learned from that was, well, one thing I learned is you can take a relationship that has been broken for your entire life and find a wonderful person and a wonderful, you know, a wonderful closeness with somebody, even though it had never been there before. But the other thing I learned was how important it was to allow myself to be helped by somebody. And I think I had, you know, always been very proud of being very self-sufficient and, you know, taking care of myself and not needing others. And I was in bad enough shape that I really needed Anna. And wonderful things came out of that. So that was a good thing to learn. I also, you know, learned a lot about culture of different disciplines by the move to computer science. As I said, it was pretty painful for the first year or two. I was so deeply immersed in the culture of pure mathematics. And, you know, initially, as I mentioned, I found the culture of computer science, theoretical computer science, off-putting because I felt that it wasn't rigorous enough. But as I look back now, the move to computer science turned out to be one of the best choices of my life because I ended up being able to work in both mathematics and computer science and combine those two disciplines in many different ways. I also learned the importance of being willing to learn a new discipline and how important it is to be able to learn to function in the culture as well as to learn the knowledge. And, you know, one of the things I've since looked at in terms of, you know, interdisciplinary work is that usually the problems in interdisciplinary work happen because people haven't realized about the differences in culture, and they get upset about things that they wouldn't be upset about if they realized that was what was going on. And so that ended up being a very important lesson. And then when I think about Nick, you know, he was just the opposite kind of person I ever thought I would marry. We had such different interests. And yet, you know, I say over and over again, marrying Nick was absolutely the very best thing that ever happened to me. And the fact that the right person for me to marry turned out to be someone that I would never have dreamt of being the right person, you know, caused me to really be much more willing to explore and examine things that, you know, on the surface don't look like they would be what you wanted to do or the right choice of those kinds of things. Because it taught me that, you know, what you expect to be right isn't necessarily like right. And if you always sort of, if you allow your biases to blind you, you're going to miss some really important things. And then the last thing I should mention is that during that period of time, while I was in graduate school, probably my second year of graduate school, I started painting watercolors. And, you know, I started painting because there was a postdoc who was learning to paint watercolors and a faculty member in the math department who was learning to paint watercolors. And we all just sort of started trying to paint together. None of us were taking lessons. And this, you know, became one of my all-time passions and still, you know, I mean, will be for the rest of my life. And it's just so funny that it happened because of people in the math department at the University of Alberta. And, you know, you never know when something's going to come along that just transforms your life.
You know, there's some really great stories and experiences that you've shared during this interview. Now, based upon those early years, if you were conducting this interview, what three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing I would question would be something like, you know, why did I have such a turbulent life, especially during my university years? And the second one would be, there's a recurring theme of loneliness, my first roughly 30 years, and how did that influence my choices? And then the final one would be, you know, How did being female influence what happened during this period? Because I was definitely doing lots of things that most females didn't do. So the answer to the first one about why things were so turbulent, I really believe that my father also had a very turbulent life, and I view myself as to a very large extent having inherited his personality, though with a little bit more balance. And again, I think my daughter Sasha has inherited my personality, but with significantly more balance and so on. So, you know, I think it's genetically being balanced out. And this personality is one with extraordinarily intense emotions and an extraordinary stubbornness and a need to challenge everything and to find your own answers to everything. And, you know, for my father, it resulted in his, you know, several times he, you know, resigned from a job without having another job to go to, just in anger at the unfairness or, you know, discrimination or whatever in different situations. And this is, you know, somebody who has several, is married, has several children, and so on. And he just was an extraordinary person. Wonderful in many ways, and also just a very difficult person to live with in many ways too. And so I think that an enormous amount of sort of my what happened between roughly age 18 and 28 or so was just trying to sort out who I was going to be and sort of, you know, like separate myself from this enormous influence that my father had on me, but also deal with just having a very, very intense personality that, it's just hard to describe what it's like having, you know, just such intense emotions about so many different things. And, you know, I remember, you know, many people, you know, saying to me at various points, you know, like, you're just too emotional. And it's hard for people to, I think it's very wearing on people around you when you have that kind of intensity of a personality. And it's certainly something I've spent, you know, a great deal of time trying to tone down so that it is just less, you know, so it's easier for people, easier for me, but also easier for the people around me. The second one about the recurring loneliness. I always have felt extraordinarily different from everybody else. And this is sort of weird because I just said that, you know, I'm very much like my father. But I would say different from the other students around me, the other kids around me, the other at different ages. And, you know, a big part of that, I think, is being female and having a lot of aspects of my personality that are much more acceptable in males in our culture than they are in females. And I'd say that the time when this really changed quite significantly for me is meeting Nick, because it gave me someone that, even though Nick and I have a lot of differences, we have a lot of shared values together, but it certainly gave me somebody who I feel really understands me and supports me through absolutely everything, and that helped a lot. But, you know, I'm now, I would say, to a large extent, a people person who has lots of friends, who knows lots of people and things like that. But that is sort of like that's like another layer that got developed as I got older. And it's real, but I think I certainly, the loneliness is something that, it means that, so for example, I have this close friend, Jennifer Chase, who works for Microsoft Research, and we really discovered each other about 10 years ago. And when we started to talk about our lives, there were so many similarities, and it was such a sense of relief to find another female who had been through, you know, similar kinds of things and who had to deal with the same kinds of issues. And so there's this theme that runs backwards and forwards between, you know, feeling very isolated and then, you know, meeting people where you can actually bond and having this intense sense of discovering somebody who can understand who you are. And then a bit about being female. So what's interesting during this period of time is that even though, this is embarrassing, but it's true, I basically thought females were sort of weaker, less desirable models than the male model. And I was very proud that I was so much like a male. And, you know, people would say to me all the time, they would say, well, you know, you're female, but you think just like a male. Or, you know, you're the first female who really thinks about these things in the right way. And I would sort of like, yeah, you know, like this is cool. I'm the guy. And it's only really in the next stage of my life when I start to realize that that's just wrong, that, you know, people should be able to be feminine and still be respected as a mathematician or computer scientist and still be able to be a leader and all these different kinds of things. So I would say, you know, the first roughly 30 years of my life, I'm very focused on the fact that I'm as male as anybody else. And it's really the next 30 years of my life where I discover that, you know, that is not the right way of seeing the world. It's not the right way for anyone to see the world, but it's certainly not the right way for me as a woman who's going to be a leader in and, you know, try to make the worlds of science and engineering, mathematics, computer science, ones that are accessible to people who are not like the dominant culture. But the first 30 years, I'm very much, in many ways, on gender issues, I'm mimicking the dominant culture, which is the male culture, and, you know, like, just being really proud of myself that I fit into that culture so well.
Well, Maria, you've taken us on a fascinating journey in this first of an interview series, and I know your schedule is demanding, so we thank you for coming in to do this interview, and we're very fortunate you were able to share your wisdom with our audience.
Yeah, well, I feel like shared my trials and tribulations with the audience. But, you know, I feel incredibly lucky that, you know, one of the things that, you know, I mentioned briefly was that I was quite suicidal when I was 13. And again, I was very suicidal after, in the aftermath of this relationship that didn't work. And I feel very lucky that I survived the first 30 years because there were definitely some really hard times. But, you know, I had some amazing support and some amazing experiences that certainly have shaped what I've done with the rest of my life.
Well, you continue to be an icon, a mentor, a luminary on a global level, impacting in so many different areas and domains, and I thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Stephen. It's always a joy to talk with you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Maria Clave, pioneering world-renowned computer scientist, president of HMC, board director of Microsoft and Broadcom, speaker, IFIP World CIO Forum, past dean of engineering, professor of computer science at Princeton University, former vice president and dean of science at UBC in Canada. This is the first in an interview series where we explore Maria's considerable history from her early years into her professional life of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions in a number of fields, including societal causes. In the next interview, we will delve into Maria's early professional career as an academic and researcher.